Hi, everybody. I'm Dottie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I love being sober. And I love being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's good to be here. I've had a little problem with getting to San Diego for some reason. I came down last night because I had to speak in Encinitas. And I worked yesterday, so I didn't get off till late. And I got all ready to come down, and then I stopped to get gas on the way, and I locked my keys in the car. And, you know, and it was one of those places where they have the little cubicles, you know, and they can't come out of their little cage thing. And I kept saying, well, is there anything I can do? And he didn't speak a lot of English either. And he just kept saying he couldn't help me, you know. And then every car that would come, I mean, there I am, you know, and everything's in the car, my purse, everything, you know. And then as people came up, I kept asking everybody, do you have a coat hanger? And do you have this, you know? And they just looked at me weird, you know, and would drive away. And then it was so funny because then I finally got one gal, and I told her what had happened, and she said, oh, well, she said, I always carry an extra one in my wallet. And I said, well, it wouldn't have done me any good because my wallet's locked in the car. But, you know, finally, you'll never believe, after about a half hour, and who rescued me? The Boy Scouts. I mean, that's for real. I couldn't believe it. I mean, you know. But they did. They came up, a bunch of them were going someplace, and they had this big van full of Boy Scouts, the little ones, 8 and 9, you know. Little. And they didn't have a hanger either, but they went to get one. And it was so neat, you know, because the whole troop, you know, I mean, there's all, you know, that once they found one, they came, and all these little kids came out running, we found it, we found it, you know, everything. It was just wonderful, and I hugged them all. But anyway, and then, of course, I got to the meeting late, you know. But anyway, I've been down with my oldest daughter and our three grandsons all weekend, and then coming tonight, we had plenty of time, except the one to pick up the kids, you know, the car fell in a ditch. And then we had to get it towed out before anything could be, before I could go to change clothes, and we're rushing, and so we get in the car, and I'm nervous, and I throw coffee on myself, and down the front of me, and so, I mean, I just think that, now you ought to just give it to me for getting here, I mean, really now. Thank you. Oh, God, and it's funny because I didn't even really worry about it too much, you know. I mean, I just kind of had fun, you know, doing it, and kind of laughed, you know. I didn't have to yell or holler or anything, because I just knew that if I was supposed to be there, I was going to be there, and if in whatever time, and I just kept saying, you know, on the way down as I'm driving the freeway, you know, because I got stuck in that thing in the service station for so long, I just kept saying, thank you, God. I know it's because you didn't want to be at a certain place at a certain time to be in an accident. You wanted me safe. Oh, God, you know. And you just kind of have to turn things around, you know. And the only way you learn that's through a lot of pain. You know, and I'm here to tell you, I've been through a lot of pain. And so since I don't like it too much, I'm trying to just roll with the punches. And I've had a few punches. But I guess that doesn't tell you how I got here. But you can see that, I mean, the way I am now with almost 24 years of sobriety, I mean, you can imagine me before I got here. You know, I mean, this was after that program deal, you know. But anyway, I just, I was born and raised in Kansas, which is a dry state, and there was no alcoholism in my family. And so I can't say it was because of XYZ bad thing that I'm the way I am, you know. And so I just, and like I said, there wasn't any drinking. I had a loving family, loving parents, and I was the only girl, had four brothers. And I'm sure being the only girl, I was special. I had a lot of illness when I was growing up. I had a lot of allergies, and I had asthma and hay fever. And the only thing I can remember really about growing up is trying to breathe. I mean, you know, it was just a big deal to breathe, and waiting for recess to go out behind the school and blow my nose so nobody'd hear me, you know. And then I had rashes at different pollen seasons and that, and I also had a very weak stomach, and the boys in high school used to think it was a lot of fun. You know, they'd talk about something, and I'd perform for them. And then I also, got car sick, and, you know, I'd land the big date in high school, then I'd get sick and throw up before we got there, you know. And that's very embarrassing. And I developed, when I was young, a giggling problem. And but you know that I have it under control now. But, you know, and, oh, God, you know. Yeah, I got to giggling with my grandson, you know. Oh, God, you know, but anyway. I always laughed, though. One of my biggest problems was I always laughed at the wrong time. I mean, you know, whenever the worst thing you could do would be laugh, that's when I laughed. You know, when I was in school, if a nun came and sat near me, I could giggle hysterically for no reason. And, you know, they'd come and sit by me or tap me on the shoulder, whatever they do, and it never made me stop giggling. I'd make loud screechy noises, you know. And many times they took me out of church down the center aisle, and I'm bent over in hysterics giggling all the way out. And I'd get the other kids to giggle, and they told me I was sacrilegious, and I didn't have respect for authority and all those things. And I didn't know how to tell them what was wrong, because I didn't know myself. Because it was always when the thought would go through my mind, whatever you do, don't laugh. Oh, then it was just awful. And I just couldn't control it. I was in one wedding, and I giggled so bad on the altar, I had to leave. In the middle. I mean, I had to leave. Oh, I was never in another one. You know, I mean, I always got to do the guest book. But, you know, it's just, you know, and that's before drinking. But anyway, I had, you know, a few things that happened in my childhood that did have an effect on me. Not that they aren't just normal things that happen, but it's how you react to them. And I, for some reason, have a funny reactor. It goes on the blink a lot, and I don't seem to react like other people. And I, when I was in the second or third grade, I had one little girlfriend that I used to play with and go to lunch together in recess. You know, you have your one little friend. And she always sat next to me because we had the same last letter, the last name. And one day, my mother got a call. My little friend had died, and she and her sister had both died within an hour of one another with diphtheria. And I remember they didn't have a service or anything, and the only thing I know is how I felt. And I didn't want to go to school. And I begged my mother not to make me go to school. And but she made me go anyway, and I remember how I was just scared to death, and I had to sit for a week next to that empty desk. And God, I hated it, and I didn't want recess to come, I didn't want lunch to come, I didn't want, because I just didn't know what I was going to do, who I was going to eat with, you know, all those kind of feelings that you have as a kid that you never talk about. You know, nobody ever said anything or asked you, and you just are there, and you just have those feelings, and you don't know what to do with them, and that's kind of the way I grew up. Then when I was in about the fifth or sixth grade, I used to take care of my invalid grandmother when I was a little girl, and she was confined to her bed, and in the summers, I would go over and take care of her, and then my mother, one day, we went out to the car with my little brother and my dad, and they were taking my little brother for a tonsillectomy at the hospital a block away, and my mother called me and told me to pray because they were having a hard time bringing my little brother out from under the ether, and I prayed real hard, but my little brother died, and I felt it was my fault. I thought I didn't pray hard enough. I thought, you know, if I could have prayed, maybe he'd have made it. You know how all these things, but I never said that to anybody. I never, ever told anybody how I really felt inside. And that's before television or anything. Nobody was talking about all this stuff. You just didn't know. And that's kind of the way it was. I remember every time anybody talked to me about it, I giggled and I had to run and hide. I remember the funeral and walking out of church giggling hysterically and standing at the graveside bent over in hysterics. And I felt terrible. I thought there was something weird wrong with me because I didn't think it was funny. And nobody talked to me and said, we understand. It's just hysteria coming out, you know, in another way. But nobody said that. And you know, the thing that controlled me all my life was not what other people thought of me, but what I thought other people thought of me. controlled me all my life. I spent my time out there trying to prove to you I was okay. And but those are just the kind of things that had an effect on me. After I graduated from high school, I was going away to school, and I was signed up to go to college, and I was looking forward to this. And I got sick, and they put me to bed, and they didn't know how long I was going to be there. And my other younger brother, before he also died, had been down for 3 years in bed, and I used to take care of him. And so they put me to bed, and I couldn't go away to school, and everybody else did, and there wasn't anything for me to do, really. Like I said, we didn't have a television. I mean, so the only thing I did was write letters to the kids that went away to school. But I remember after about 8 months, when the doctor said I could get up and maybe start walking a little bit and everything, and finally he said that I could go out once in a while. And you know that I had that same feeling that I had when I was a little kid and didn't want to go to school and sit next to the empty desk. I didn't want to try it again. I didn't want to go out there and try to feel how to fit in. I didn't want to try and learn how to act all over again, or whatever it was. And but eventually, of course, I did. You know, I didn't really get into any drinking. It wasn't around me, like I said, until I was in the 20s. And I remember my first cocktail, my first mixed drink. I mean, I'd had beer, you know, and this once in a while at home, you know, or that kind of thing, but I never really drank. It wasn't until I remember this cocktail, and we had gone to Denver, and these people, I had never had a cocktail, so, you know, you don't know what to order, and you don't hear the names, I mean, you don't know anything. And so people told me what to order, and I'll never forget, because they told me I should get this thing called The Thing. And he said, you like it? And so I did. And I'll never forget, because at this place, the deal was that anybody that had never been there before, you talk them into getting this thing. And anyway, when I ordered it, pretty soon this siren went off, and all these people came over, and this thing was on fire, and they put a fireman's hat on you and all that kind of stuff. And of course, I mean, it's good because I can remember it. Now, I didn't know it's going to be important to remember it, but the only thing I remember about it was that it tasted like soda pop. And, you know, and it was, it tasted good, but the thing I remember most is that I felt good. I mean, it took that knot away inside. I didn't feel as inferior. I wasn't as scared. I had more confidence. I seemed to be smarter or something. I just felt good. And I wanted another one. That's the way my drinking was. It did something for me. When I drank, it did something for me. I felt better. I could do things. I felt I could fit in. I mean, I could dance. I could talk. I could do these things, you know, if I had a drink. So every chance I got, I drank. And so I'm what you call a social drinker. Only I over-socialized. Very social. But anyway, I got sick when I drank. I was never a good drinker, but, you know, I'd thrown up all my life, you know, so it was no big deal. And I always had a built-in excuse, you know, for throwing up. And, you know, I always said it was the car ride, or somebody said a squirmish thing I must not have heard consciously, or, you know, any kind of thing like that. In fact, not too long ago, somebody gave me a bumper sticker, and it said, "Have you hugged your toilet bowl today?" And, you know, it just did something for me. I mean, it's just, it was neat. But anyway, so throwing up was no big thing. Now, I never wanted to get drunk, and I never tried to get drunk. I never said, boy, I'm going to go get drunk, because I didn't want to. I just thought, whoops. I just wanted to get to feel good. And so I just wanted to have a few drinks to take the edge off. You know, I took a big edge off. But anyway, then I did everything not to get drunk. I mean, you know, anything anybody told me you wouldn't get drunk, I'd do. I mean, I drank olive oil before I went out, because somebody said it would coat the stomach and you wouldn't get drunk. I drank cream before I went out. Somebody said you couldn't get drunk if you drank cream. And somebody told me one time if you ate chocolate, you couldn't get drunk. Now, I don't know whose bright ideas these were, but none of them worked. But I remember eating a bunch of Hershey bars before I went out. And, oh, God, I was sick. But you know, and I always ate dinner before I went out to dinner because, you know, my thought was you can't get drunk on a full stomach. And, you know, by the time you have a couple drinks and it's time to eat, you know, you'll just eat a little bit and my date would just think I was dandy and feminine, you know. The only difference was I was a fatter drunk. And then, you know, if you've had two dinners, you've got a little more to perform with. But, like I said, many things happened to me when I drank. many things that... you know, I mean, they told me that I tried to water ski behind a boat in a window display. And, you know, and I'd do the cha-cha on the table and those kind of things, you know, fun things. But, you know, they also, I started having blackouts. Now, I didn't know that's what they were called because, you know, nobody out there is talking about having blackouts. I never heard them out there. When you're out there, you know, spreading joy to the world, people aren't talking about that. And so I didn't, but I started having these... and people would tell me I did something or I said something or I knocked something over and broke it or some kind of thing they'd tell me, and I knew they were lying. I'd never do that. And, you know, because I would remember going and I'd remember coming home. I just thought it was a short night, you know. And then it got where the blackouts got closer together, though, and then I wouldn't remember coming home and I wouldn't remember where I put my car. And I remember having my younger brother, for he also died, take me out up and down trying to find my car because I didn't know where it was and I didn't know how I got home and I was scared to death and I didn't want my folks to find out and all that kind of stuff, you know, that you go through, the panic. And I always said, well, gee, I was never arrested or anything, and I wasn't. You know, one time I was stopped. Well, we weren't stopped. We were already stopped. We were asleep in the car. That's where we were, in the middle of an intersection. And... but I wasn't driving. I mean, well, she wasn't either, but anyway, I'll never forget because she, you know, I mean, there was two policemen, one on each side, and they're shining this light, and then I'm trying to tell them what good girls we are and all this and that, and oh, God, trying to invite them to a church dance. Can you imagine? Oh, trying to show them we were really nice. But anyhow, I mean, doesn't every nice girl sleep in the car with the windows rolled up in the middle of the intersection? I mean, really, after all. But anyway, they didn't even take us to jail, you know, or anything. I mean, I remember they did give us a sobriety test, but we flunked, and but we thought it was funny. I mean, that's how drunk we. I mean, we thought it was funny because he's just supposed to touch your nose, or, you know, or something, and do something and touch your nose, and she kept giggling and asking where her nose was and did I ever nose and a bunch of stuff, and we were just we're just having a ball, and I mean, you know, we didn't even realize the reality of it till the next morning, but we. They didn't take us to jail. We just promised to. We made dates with them. for the next night. Now we didn't keep them. Let me tell you, we were petrified. And God. And but you know these kind of fun things. And but like I said, I had a terrible time talking if I didn't drink. You know, I could never say the right thing, and I always got things mixed up, and I would sound stupid. So I'd sound so. But if I drank, I thought I was pretty smart. And so anyway, I drank whenever I could. One of my favorite things when I went out, because I never liked to talk, and people, every time I'd try to say something, I'd get it mixed up. I remember my first date in California. This girl from the church choir fixed me up with her cousin, and we went down on a boat, down on the marina, on a great big boat, and I had never been on a boat before, and I'd never even seen an ocean until I came to California, and the only boat I'd been on was a rowboat my daddy'd made in the garage, and on occasion, he'd take it to a little man-made lake for fishing, and that's my big boating career. And you know, if you come from Kansas, and you come to California, out here, everybody, they just know everything, and they're so worldly and everything. There's not a lot to talk about because they talk about all these fancy places and big stuff. And, you know, the only thing I knew to talk about was either the A&W or Bobo's Drive-In. You know, that's the only place I'd been. And So, no, harder I tried to think of something to say, the worse it would get. I remember my brother had a friend with a boat, and when I got a chance to say something, I said, well, I have a brother. And I said, he has a friend that has a 19-inch boat. Now, I did not know that I had said inch instead of foot, and I will never forget the look on a guy's face. Because he looked at me and said, oh, really? He said, well, what's he do, play in the bathtub with it? And, of course, I was just mortified, you know. And I didn't say anything again, of course, until I had a drink. But if I had a drink, it took that away. It just took that panic away. And so, like I said, I drank every chance I got. One of my favorite things to do when I went out, because I had this terrible fear of talking, and it was legitimate, you know. I said stupid stuff. So, but I... I used to go with this girlfriend of mine, and I'd pretend I was from a foreign country and I couldn't speak English. And it worked real neat because you didn't have to worry about what to say. And, and she'd tell them I'm from some exotic place, and then people buy you drinks and say things, and, you know, every once in a while I'd make a few funny sounds that I thought maybe this language would sound like. And everything. And, you know, I didn't even think about it until after I got sober, but we used to go to the same places. And each time I would be from some other exotic place. I didn't even have enough sense to stick with the same foreign country. And I never even thought of that. You know, they probably, you know, a lot of the same people would be in there, and they probably thought, oh, God, here she comes. I wonder where she's from tonight, you know. But I didn't even think of it at the time. And, but like I say, many things happened to me when I drank, you know, many things that are funny and hysterical, and many things I was very ashamed of. You know, I wish I hadn't done it. I wish I hadn't been there. I wish I could turn the calendar back so I didn't have to know what I'd done or said or who I'd hurt. But the thing I like to remember most is my last drunk, and it's when I came to you people. Now, it's not when I ended up in the worst situation or the worst place, but it was the end for me. And like I said, I had my last drink. It will be 24 years this Christmas. And I'm very grateful for that. It seems impossible. But anyway, I had had gone out to lunch with the girls. I worked at the telephone company as a service representative supervisor at the time, and we had gone out for lunch, which and to have drinks on Christmas Eve, I mean, doesn't everybody? You know, it was kind of all right. So I was in rare shape when I got to my family's home that Christmas Eve. Like I said, my roommates were... school teachers, and they went back in the Midwest. So I went to my family's, and we went to next door to an open house, and I was in a blackout shortly after I got there. I don't even remember anything about it until I woke up at my family's home the next morning, and they were talking about people that were there, and I didn't even know they were there. And of course, I didn't let my family know. I made up my mind I wasn't going to drink. Because I knew long before this I could never guarantee my conduct once I took a drink. And so I wasn't going to drink, and I didn't, because we were having this big family get together, all my brothers and their wives and children and my sister-in-law's parents and neighbors and all these non-alcoholic people. So I didn't drink till dinner was on the table, and then I got to thinking, I'm only going to have one drink. I cannot possibly get drunk. I'm only going to have this one drink so I can feel part of my own family. And, of course, I had that drink. I fixed it in the kitchen in a water glass when nobody was looking. And I don't remember finishing the drink. I don't remember anything until I came to sometime in the middle of the night. And it was dark outside. And I was in bed at my family's home. And I just laid there with my thoughts. You know, what did I say? What did I do? Who did I hurt this time? No matter how hard I tried to remember, I couldn't. And as I laid there with my thoughts, trying to think of a way to get up and get out of the house, I thought, if I can just get up and get out of this house so I don't have to find out what I've done or what I've said or who I hurt. I just wanted out. And as I was trying to think of a way to get out of the house, I heard my mother up. And I'm sure my mother was up because she was unable to sleep, laying in there worrying about me. But anyway, as soon as I heard her, I got up and I met her in the hall. And my mother had that look in her eye that every alcoholic has seen in the eyes of the people that love them. You know, it doesn't matter if it's your mother or your father or your husband or your wife or your children. Every alcoholic has seen that hopeless, helpless, bewildered, fearful, panicky, disgusted look that the non-alcoholic has. That's the look my mother had. And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, why do you drink so much? I was so ashamed of you again." And I couldn't stand it. You know, I wish I could have looked at her and said, "Mom, you don't understand. The only reason I drink like this is it's the only thing that makes me feel equal with other people. It's the only thing that makes me function. You know, Mom, I've never wanted to make you ashamed. The only thing I've ever wanted to do is make you proud of me. I wish I could go out there and be like my brothers. You know, no matter what they did, they made the folks proud of them. But you see, I hadn't been to you people yet, and I didn't know those things. So the only thing I could do is the same thing I'd done so many times before, and that's look at the floor so I didn't have to look in her eyes. Tell her to get off my back and leave me alone because I had more important things to do than listen to her bitch at me. Of course, I got out of there, but it wasn't soon enough because they told me of some of my performance and how I'd embarrassed the whole family and how they were also ashamed of me and they hadn't raised me to be this type of a person and where had they gone wrong and why was God punishing them and on. But anyway, I got out of there and then I got in my car driving back home crying hysterical, praying to die. And I thought, I just said, "God, I don't know why you made the mistake of putting me here on this earth. And if you did make the mistake of putting me here, I don't know why you leave me. I don't know why you didn't take me rather than my younger brother. He could have amounted to something. You know, my parents are good, decent people. They don't deserve having someone like me in the family." And finally I said, "God, if there's anything that you have for me to do in this lifetime, I wish you would please show me what it is and show me how to do it." Well, shortly after this, I thought of a girlfriend of mine. She and I at one time had belonged to an organization called Bachelorette. And she had joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and she married, and she had a new baby, and she lived real close to me. And so I called her on the phone, got her out of bed. And she, of course, I didn't tell her I had a problem. I just, you know, she wanted to know what I wanted, and I said I wanted to come and see what she got for Christmas. And So she told me I couldn't come over till 1 o'clock, and I didn't think 1 o'clock would ever get there. But anyway, it was finally time, and I got over there. And I didn't any more than get there till there was an AA couple. You know how they are, you know. Both of them sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what'd they do but drink coffee and talk about Alcoholics Anonymous? So I would listen. I thought, well, this will be interesting. And I'll never forget because the guy mentioned the word blackout. And I said, "What's that?" He said, "It's when you drink so much you can't remember." Boy, I shut up and didn't ask any more questions. And then he followed it by saying, he said, "Do you know that every time you have a blackout, you get brain damage?" Oh, God, you know, I was never the brightest thing in the world to begin with. And I thought, oh, Lord, now I've got all this brain damage stuff, you know. And I couldn't wait till they jolly hoed out. And they didn't any more than leave till another AA came wonderful and through, and she finally left, and I got up the nerve to say, "I may have had one of those ones." And I said, "I'd just like to know what I can drink so I won't get drunk." And she said, "Seven Up." And, of course, I never thought of that. But anyway, she took me to my first meeting that Friday after Christmas. Now, I certainly was not an alcoholic when I came here. I mean, I came as a visitor. Because alcoholics were those people that had all those kids they didn't feed. And I was single. I certainly couldn't be an alcoholic, you know. And anyway, she took me to this meeting, about 135 people there. And back then in our area, they didn't have the new people stand and raise their hand or give their name or anything. They just said, "Did anybody bring any newcomers? And if so, would you please stand and introduce them?" Well, when they said this, I turned around to look. You know, I wanted to see what they looked like when they brought them in. And as I'm facing these people, she stood up. And she pulled me up and she said, "This is Dottie, and it's her first meeting." I almost died. I thought, my God, my life is over. The word is out. I mean, you know, I could imagine, you know, I could just see him running, you know. I'm an alcoholic, God, I could just see him. You know, there wasn't anything on TV then or anybody talking about Alcoholics Anonymous or anything like that. I mean, it was a hush-hush deal then. And now it's kind of in. But, you know, back then it wasn't. And I thought, well, you know, there's nothing left to do but go to these meetings, be miserable the rest of my life, you know. And I'm sure, you know, if you learn how to be a martyr, you know, the thing that you have to learn is in AA, you got to stand in line. And they play this game, can you top this? I mean, you know, no matter how much of a major sadness you've got, somebody else has got it worse, you know, or something. Really gripes you when you want attention, too, especially from your sponsor, you know. And but anyway, she told me to get a lot of telephone numbers, and she said, call before you take a drink or any mood-changing chemical. She said, if you take a drink and call us, we will hang up on you. We will not talk to you because you're going to have to finish out your drunk. Well, now, I remember one of the times that I needed to talk to someone. I mean, I thought, I'm sure I had some type of a major sadness of some kind. And I decided to call, and everybody had gone to a big roundup, and I couldn't afford to go. And so I didn't, and I, my sponsor and all the people I was close to had gone. And I would call people, but I wouldn't, you know, you don't tell them anything. You just, hi, you know, and they were either changing the baby or sitting down for dinner, whatever they were doing. And I'd say, oh, okay, and I'd hang up, you know, and be mad at him. But, you know, I forgot whatever it was I was sad about because I had him mad. You know, as long as you have some kind of a negative emotion to nurture when you're new, you're in your comfort zone, you know. And you know, but I thought, you know, but I thought, oh, so I'm going to, you know, I'll wait till I get to the meeting and tell them off. And you know how you think, but you never do it. You know, they may not like you. But anyway, you know, you think these things. And but you know what I found out from that? And it wasn't then. It wasn't until years later I found out that it really didn't matter what anybody said on the other end of the line. And it wasn't even important if they answered the phone. The important thing was that I did the footwork and I took the action. I did what they asked me to do, and I'm here sober almost 24 years. And that's all I've done. I've done what they've asked me to do. Now, not because I wanted to and not because I thought it would work and I wanted, you know, any of that. I never took a job. I was never out there trying to get some job or trying to be this. I never wanted them. I said, oh, no, no, you know, and all this and everything. I know the first time they asked me to speak at a participation meeting, I said, oh, no, no, I'm too new, I can't. And you give you a little fit, and they make you do it anyway. They said, all you have to do is get up and state your name and your disease, and then you can sit down. Well, that's all I did for years. I still had my giggling problem, and I would say, I'm Dottie, I'll call it, giggle hysterically, and I'd go sit down. And they did nickname me Giggles. And they made me secretary after I was sober a year, but they had to read a bunch of announcements, and I got up the first week and became hysterical, and somebody else had to read them, and I tried the next week, same results, and they made me treasurer. But I did do, you know, I typed minutes for the bulletin for central office, and all those jobs, you know, that you do that you don't want to do, but they tell you to go, and you go back 10 years later, and they're all still trying to resolve the same things they talked about 10 years ago, you know, but they have a lot of fun, you know, and they're figuring all these giant things out. But anyway, I did what they asked me to do, and then I had the type of sponsor, too, that no matter what happened, I mean, she was one of these, read the book. Oh, God. I mean, how, you know, I could say, I had a flat tire, and she could say, read the book, you know, I mean, like, that's going to do you any good. I mean, how's reading the book going to fix your flat tire? Or no matter what it was, she'd say, have you written your inventory? You know, like, that's going to fix, you know, get you a raise or whatever, you know, and whatever the problem is. And she told me I had to read part of the big book every day. Well, God, you know, I was not a good reader, and I'm still slow today, but she told me I had to read some. But then she said, all you have to do is read one paragraph. Well, heck, even I could read one paragraph, you know. And did you know I don't remember one time reading one paragraph? You know, I'd have several pages. Pretty soon, you know how when you've done something that they told you to do, and you're so proud of yourself, you can't wait to get to the meeting and tell them, and then they're too busy with all these people that came in after you to listen, you know. And then you start to go away mad at them. Of course, you don't let them know you're mad. You're just going to make them hurt a little, you know. So you turn to leave, and she'd say, I want to talk to you, you know. And then, you know, you'd be the last one she's talking to in the parking lot, and you'd finally get your big chance. And I told her, I finished the big book. And she'd say, good, then you start over, you know. Yeah. But anyway, like I said, I just did what they asked me to do, and And like I said, I was single when I came in, and it was always like 10 couples and Dottie, 15 couples and Dottie. You know, we had this 4th of July picnic one time, and one girl said, I don't want to go because I don't have a date. And somebody said, that's okay, Dottie will be there. But anyway, you know, believe it or not, I got married on this program. I was 4 years sober, and I married another member of this fellowship. He was a widower, and he had 2 children. And so I became a wife and a mother all at the same time. And so I... you know, had to learn how to be a mother and a wife, and you know, gave up my job so I could raise the children. They'd been without a mother for a while, needed one, and you know, I was going to be the perfect mother. And oh God. Anyway, you know, the things they used to say, it was so funny, I've forgotten about them. Some of them, being with my grandkids this weekend, and daughter, it was so funny, some of the things. Trying to cook, you know, for these kids. I mean, you know, you don't have any practice time. They just are, you know, and they have ideas of their own. And, you know, saying, I remember one of them saying, what's the difference between burnt and scorched? You know, they'd say, this is burnt. And I'd say, no, it's not. It's just scorched. Oh, God, you know. And, you know, but I mean, you have all this crazy stuff going on, you know. Oh, mercy. But, you know, we went through a lot of growing pains and a lot of fun, and I was involved in, with the Boy Scouts. I was able to tell them, oh, yes, I was involved in Girl Scouts, you know, and a bunch of stuff, you know, playground mother, ice cream lady, you know, all the things you do at school and all this kind of stuff, and I had a lot of fun in growing up and trying to learn things. And you know, you just kind of go along and do the things that you're asked to do, and apply these principles to your life to the best of your ability. You just, no matter what, that's what you do. And, you know, the reason you do those things is not because right at the moment it has to be done, but you never know what's going to come up on down the road and when you're going to have to call on the good habits and the things that you have planted, all the seeds that you've planted. You know, someday you may have to call on every single one of them, and every little prayer that you've ever uttered, and everything, just to make it one day. Because that's what's happened to me. I the last 3 years have been the worst years of my life. Everything negative that could happen in my life has happened. Many, many losses in every area. And I had, within a 3-year period, I mean, I had, well, we had a business that went upside down and lost all that, and the work involved, and a partnership breakup that was painful, and just stress, unbelievable, trying to deal with all of these things. And at the same time that all this was going on, within a few months of one another, I lost both of my parents. And then we had, and the month before my mother died, one of my dearest friends passed away. And 2 days after my mother, my aunt died. And we were robbed, had cars stolen. We even had lightning strike. Can you believe that, in California? And it just seemed like one negative thing right after another happened. It was like I was just about to get up, and a wave would knock you over, and you just about get dried off, and another wave would hit, and you just about get dried off, and all of a sudden a typhoon hit. And it took it all. And my husband left a little over a year ago, and I'm married right away, and I was devastated. I was shocked. I had no idea. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was after all these losses, and I had found shortly, you know, a few years ago, I have a hereditary blood disease, and I had been in the hospital just a few months before that, and the doctors had painted bad pictures for me, and I had been there with, that's what my mother and my aunt died from, and my aunt had been locked up in the hospital for the last 10 years. And I knew what had happened to my mother, and they like to scare you and say these things. And I have two cousins, one in Pennsylvania, one in Kansas, that have it. But anyway, so I'll tell you, it was a tough time for me. Of course, watching the people that you love, the children and everything, and their reactions to this thing was also devastating, also. And, it's like, naked one more time before God, and everything is taken away. 10 days after I found out about this, my little dog that I walked with every morning was hit and killed by a car. And I'll tell you, I didn't know if I was going to make it, but I didn't want to make it. I'd hoped I didn't make it. I remember laying on the floor, hysterical, and I said, God, you mean I can't even have a dog? And you've taken it all. And I can't even have a little dog? And I vacillated at first between homicide and suicide. And trying to just deal with it. I was in such shock for a while. It was hard to deal with anything. And I didn't know where to start, and it's awful hard being there by yourself trying to figure out where to start and what to do. I hadn't been in the work field for a long time, and I had to try and get myself together, trying to deal with all of the devastation in itself and all of the feelings. Every negative emotion that's possible came up within me. I mean, I had rage that I had never felt. I had this anger. I had jealousy. I'd never been jealous before. I had had all of these kind of feelings just rise up in me. Fear, tremendous fear of with the blood disease and not have been in the work field and how I was going to take care of myself and with no family or anything. And I was kind of immobilized. I mean, it was hard to, there was so much going on mentally. It was hard to just function in a physical manner. I'd had a lot of practice here in walking when you don't know what else to do. And I was there physically. I would do what I had to do and keep my commitments and go even though the head may not be there. Being in a boxing ring. And you're not even prepared and you're the boxer. There I was, and all of a sudden a bell would go ding and they'd push you out there, And somebody's out there beating your brains out, And then, you're down for the count. 8, 9, and just about that time you're hoping that, they'll finish you off and all of a sudden ding and they pull you out back, Then they get you in a little corner and they start bandaging you up and trying to stop the bleeding. And then, you got your little AA and Al-Anon sponsors there and they're going, yay, yay, doing good, and everything. And you think, God, it's easy for them to say. They're on the sidelines, And just about the time you think, well, God, maybe I'll make it, then ding, and they push you out again. And then somebody's beating you to pieces, shredding your very being, out there. And they're on the side going, yay, yay, and then all of a sudden, ding, and they pull you off, And just about that time, ding, and they push you off, And they say things to you as they're pushing you out there. They say things like, he never gives you any more than you handle. I said, he has this time, or else they say things like, just look at the growth. You're going to get such depth. Now, believe me, I liked it shallow. I mean, I'd say, I don't want to go deep. I want to be shallow. I like it shallow. Give me shallow. Oh, God, give me shallow, they'd say, then they'd say, no pain, no gain. all those fun little things they tell you, as they're throwing you in the ring, and they're sitting calmly on the side. But eventually, sometime, finally, the last bell goes ding, and they pull you off, and you're broken, and you're shredded, and you don't know how you're ever going to get back together again. You don't want to get back together. And you're kind of, it's like, you know, being hit by a truck or it's kind of like an airplane. You know, I like being in an airplane crash and everybody else is bailed out. And you didn't even have a parachute. And you didn't even know you were supposed to bail out. And you're the only one that went down in the crash. And you're first immobilized, you can't function. It's like being in traction. When they first find you, you're in traction and you can't move. The only thing that goes is the mind. And you're trying to think, well, when I can move, you know. And my prayers would, I mean, they vacillated from one thing to another. I mean, one time I'd cry and say, oh, God, help, and the next time, oh, God, take me, I don't want to make it, I can't make it, what have you done, you know, and let you up to walk a little bit, and then you get, you're back in traction for a while again, and you can't. Everything is overwhelming. I mean, to mail something is a project, and it's just too much trouble. And that kind of thing. It's hard to deal with some of these things. And every negative feeling you can feel, I mean, I felt old. I felt thrown away. I felt outcast and abandoned. I felt used. I felt fear. And, of course, all my inheritance was already gone. And I was out there trying to figure out how I'm going to make it, you know. All of these feelings, but you know, I mean, it was some of the worst time in my life, but also some of the best time because I spent an awful lot of time with God. And you know, I mean, just crying out to Him constantly. I mean, daily. I mean, I didn't sleep. I just would wake up early. If I would sleep, it'd be short times, and I'd wake up and I'd read a lot. I'd read the Bible, as well as the books and the things, and a lot of different literature on things. When I could function, I prayed a great deal. And God is there, and He always answers. And I have learned through this time to listen. You know, it's easy to be out there and going and not have time to listen. But you know, God's always talking to us. And today, I have a communication with God, a personal relationship with God that I didn't have before. I wouldn't trade it for anything. At times would say, God, why are you letting this happen? I know you're not sending it, but why do you let it happen? Because, you see, I know that God can turn anything the enemy sends, that God can turn it around for good. And I think, well, God, you know, how come you let this happen? But I found out that really it was His gracious love calling me to Him. When we get in those situations, His love is so strong, it calls us and woos us to Him. Because that's what He's done for me. One day when I didn't think I was going to make it, I do a lot of reading in bed in the morning, 3 and 4 and 5 in the morning, and I was reading and crying and talking to God and everything, and all of a sudden something, we had the sliding glass door, something flew across in front of me and went splat, and the cat jumped up and grabbed it, and I thought, oh my God, it's a sparrow, and I chased the cat outside and he laid it down, it was just raw, and I went and picked it up, and it was like it was dead, and I picked it up, but I could still feel it had a heartbeat. So I took the bird and I put it up on the cinder block fence, and I tried to get the cat away from it and get him in the house and everything. And finally, as I'm going in the house, getting this cat away from it, these words came to my mind, and it said, "Not a sparrow shall fall from the sky that I am not aware of. How much more important are you, my child?" And I started to cry because I knew God was with me. And I knew He knew every feeling I had ever had. And I knew He knew every tear I'd shed and that He loved me. And I knew it. I didn't think it. It wasn't because somebody told me. I knew it. I knew God loved me.
And I know he loves me today because I listen to him today. And I have a good life. I mean, it's still tough. I'm still trying to walk out of the tunnel. But I'm at least walking toward the sun. You see, God's wooed me to him. You know, I mean, he wants me to be closer to him and to his son. And, you know, anything, I'm here to tell you, if nothing else, that you can stay sober no matter what. Because, you know, not one time did I think of taking a drink. Not one time did I think a drink would make it better. Not one time did I think a pill could make it better. Not one time did that even enter my mind. And that's a miracle. And you see, I believe all of you are here because God has called you. With his love, he's wooing you to him because he wants relationship with his children. And he loves us. He loves us back to health, and he's still in the miracle business. And anybody that's ever gone to an AA meeting knows that. Because they see it in the eyes. They see someone come in who is lost and scared and outcast and lonely and thrown away and not wanted. And many times the people that you've trusted most and you've loved the most, you know, in your life, have rejected you. And now that's rejection. I mean, you know, when the people that you love the most and trust, when they throw you away, you know you're no good. But you see, sometimes that's when God calls you the most, and he's here to love you back to health with the real love, the unconditional love. And we see it in the eyes of the people here because all of a sudden you see a light go on in their eyes. And you know they're going to be all right. You know, I'm going to stop now, but one little thing I heard a fellow talk about not too long ago. I was on TV or it was someplace, and it was a fellow from New Zealand. And he had was an actual shepherd. And he was talking about the sheep. And you know how you've seen that picture of you know, the shepherd carrying the sheep around his, the neck? And I'd seen it, but I never thought anything about it. But he said that when they had one, a little baby lamb that was a strayer, and they knew it wasn't, it kept going away because other ones would follow it, the shepherd would take it and break a bone, a little bone in its leg, and it couldn't walk. And that's when he carried it. And it just took a few days for it to heal. And every time the lamb would do so much to get, you know, to get down, then he'd get it down, but it couldn't walk. So then it would be glad to be held for a while. But then once it was mended and he put it down, it always stayed close to the shepherd. It never strayed. And you know, that's with us. We've all been broken sometime or someplace in our life. And we know that through that time, the shepherds carried us. And here we are, together, with a chance for joy. And you find out what's important. You know, I never saw a hearse go by with a U-Haul behind it. And you know, the mansions of today are the slums and the tenement houses of tomorrow. And the fancy clothes you have today, you're wiping up grease under the car. And they turn to dust, even our body. The only thing that's important is what's in our heart. That's the only thing that's important. And my net worth is what's in here. Because it's the only thing that's going to live forever. And I'm just grateful to be sober, and I'm grateful to be here. I love being sober, and I love being a member of AA. Thank you.